This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. We all know if something sounds too good to be true, it probably is. Some of us have learned that the hard way, but when it comes to money, there is something irresistible about something for nothing, about putting money in a just-can't-lose endeavor with the promise of quick, easy, and bountiful returns. When these get-rich-quick opportunities actually make fraudulent claims and those offering them are engaged in illegal activities, they become Ponzi schemes. And that's a term from the 1920s. Why, back then, there was even a popular song about this man, Charles Ponzi, who preyed on unsuspecting people with dollar signs in their eyes, leaving most of them destitute.
They rushed to the bank and drew out their coins with no thought of what was in store. But Ponzi was clever. He made them all think that their hard-working days were over.
Even though the original Ponzi scheme took place almost 90 years ago, schemes just like that one have continued almost unabated. Here in North Carolina, about 15 such schemes have been investigated this year alone, and one of the largest was based just outside of Charlotte, bringing about $850 million in gains for the perpetrators and hundreds of millions of dollars in losses for hundreds of thousands of victims here in Charlotte, in North Carolina, and in fact, around the world.
Hard-earned savings of years, and many a widow will tell you her tale while her eyes are filled with tears.
That song may have been recorded in the 1920s, but it could just as easily been recorded in the aftermath of the scheme I just talked about, or about the Bernie Madoff scandal. This hour, we're taking a closer look at the Ponzi and pyramid schemes that have been uncovered in North Carolina so that you will be better equipped to spot and avoid getting trapped by them. Robert Fitzpatrick is president of Pyramid Scheme Alert and co-author of the book False Prophets. He's been on this program several times in the past. Welcome back.
Thank you, Mike. Happy to be here.
Nice to have you here. He joins us in our studio, and with us by phone is Jordan McLitch. He is an attorney in Tampa, Florida at Wyangara King, practicing securities law and business litigation. He's also the author of Ponzi Tracker. That's an internet blog tracking the proliferation of Ponzi schemes across the country. Thank you for joining us as well.
Thanks for having me, Mike.
And also in our studio, WFAE's Tom Bullock, who did a story on schemes being conducted here in Charlotte and around the state, and he has a plethora of information to bring to the table. Thank you for being here, too.
Thanks, Mike.
Jordan, your blog, Ponzi Tracker, tracks what it describes as the proliferation of Ponzi schemes around the country. What do you mean by proliferation?
Well, Mike, in about late 2008, Bernie Madoff was charged with what is now recognized as the largest Ponzi scheme in history. In the years that followed, coupled with the economic downturn, hundreds of these Ponzi schemes began to be exposed. When I began practicing as an attorney several years ago, one of the roles that I played was being counsel to the court-appointed receiver in a $350 million Ponzi scheme here in Sarasota, in Tampa. So when I became counsel, I started seeing that more and more of these Ponzi schemes were popping up, and unfortunately, there was no centralized resource to start tracking them. So that was the genesis of what is now Ponzi Tracker, and you know, it's since morphed and taken a whole life of its own. But you know, it was started to provide a resource to people, not only educational, but you know, to allow them to identify potential signs of Ponzi schemes.
So, are there more Ponzi schemes in the aftermath of Bernie Madoff, more than there were from, say, 1920 when Charles Ponzi was caught between 1920 and 2014? And has it grown exponentially since then, or has it just been kind of bubbling under, and maybe we didn't have the wherewithal to discover these criminals?
I think it's a little both. You know, I don't have scientific data from the periods before when Madoff was uncovered. You know, I can tell you just as a general matter, there certainly wasn't the amount of attention and scrutiny as there was then. But just as an observation, you know, since 2008, there's been more than 500 Ponzi schemes. Mm. So, whatever data set you're going to compare that to, that's still out of this world.
Tom Bullock, you spoke with Kurt Myers, who is the U.S. attorney in the Western District of North Carolina. He cites the economic downturn as somewhat being responsible. But now that we're coming out of this, does the problem persist because a certain segment of the population has been unaffected by the upturn?
I think that's fair, Mike. I really do. And Kurt was really interesting when I interviewed him for the story, because he said basically the bad economic times were, you know, they were great and they were terrible for Ponzi schemes. And they were great because for people who suddenly had, you know, lost income, or they felt that they had lost a lot economically, they were a larger pool of victims. And then, you know, with bad economy, people are looking to cash in on what investments they have, or in this case think they have, mm-hmm. because they need the cash. So Kurt, you know, he was very honest about it. You know, the bad economy helps them find it, but it also helps fuel them.
Which is what led to the Bernie Madoff collapse, because the bad economy called people wanted their money. And
that's exactly right.
He didn't have it. Robert, you have been on this program, as I said several times in the past, talking mostly about pyramid schemes, which are more things like multi-level marketing programs. Not all Ponzi schemes are pyramid schemes, but all pyramid schemes are Ponzi schemes, aren't they?
Yeah, I think that's an accurate way of saying it. They are both fundamentally the same, in the sense that earlier investors are paid from newer investors, not from an underlying profitable enterprise. So both require a constant inflow of new capital, and that really is the source of the money. That makes them both unsustainable and also requires that they cause harm.
And these pyramid schemes, these multi-level marketing pyramid schemes, seem to come and go in waves. There'll be a time when you hear a lot about them, and there'll be a time when you hear nothing about them. I would take it that you're hearing a lot about them in certain time periods because people are looking for a way to make money that they can't do in their ordinary lives. If a pyramid scheme is in a period of being flourishing, does that mean Ponzi schemes might be too?
It seems to go together. Like Jordan said, I don't think there's academic data or research data on this, but the psychology of them is very similar. Mm-hmm. And the environment in which they grow is also similar, in that normal, traditional work seems less attractive to people and less opportunity for it, whereas speculative money seems to be everywhere. And that's what you hear. Most of the money made in the last since our recovery has been in the stock market. Well, making money on the stock market is not really business. It's a money transfer. It's a speculative thing. And so Ponzi schemes and pyramid schemes mimic that.
Well, and there's one thing that's I find really interesting, what you just said and what we have now. If you go back to Ponzi's original scheme, one of the things that really kicked it into high gear was an article in the Boston Post in the early 1920s. Actually, it was early 1920, where they interviewed early investors and said, you know, he's actually giving you a 50% return in 90 days. And if you look at the actual page, right below that is an ad for a bank that is proudly saying, we will give you 5% return on your savings account mm-hmm. per year. Mm-hmm. So there's a time when all of a sudden you think, I'm not going to make money any other way. You know, you're not getting interest paid. You're not, at least at a high enough rate. But all of a sudden, somebody comes along with that special something, and you think, that's it.
So, Jordan, when banks are paying less than 1% on a savings account, and bonds aren't paying very much either, and the only place to really get any kind of return on your investment is in the stock market. And when periods of time like that go on in the financial world, does that make things ripe for these schemes?
Yeah, I think you've hit on an interesting point, and it's something that, you know, through my analysis and just tracking these things for several years, you know, several clear trends have emerged. You know, when you have, you know, booming times in the stock market, you know, a person offering 10, 15, 20% annual returns, you know, it doesn't sound too crazy when they start offering those, because you think, hey, I could have just plunked my money in the market and made 30% last year.
Mm-hmm.
So I think when you see economic times increasing, people's wealth increasing, I think you see more inflows into suspect frauds. You also see more people popping up saying that they can replicate these frauds. Then, you know, to me, what I've told people is, you know, the economy is a lagging indicator of Ponzi schemes. When the economy starts going back down, people start losing money in other places, speculative places. Then they go to these investments that they've considered guaranteed or safe harbors. And when all these outflow requests start piling up on these fraudsters and they don't have the money to pay them back, that's when these schemes start collapsing, and often it's in droves.
But you know, when the economy went bad, when it went south in 2008, a lot of people lost a lot of money in legitimate investments, and a lot of banks, a lot of investment houses went down because they didn't have the money to back up what the investors had put in. So how can you tell the difference between somebody who's cheating you, legitimately cheating you, and he knows he's cheating you, and he knows he doesn't have the money to pay everybody that he's got under his investment wing back, versus these banks that couldn't do it either?
Due diligence. I mean, it sounds funny, and I'd love to hear what, Jordan, what you have to say about this as well, but it's tricky. I mean, when I was a child, I was about 8 or 9 years old, my dad took me on a business trip to California, and one of the partners for the business that he was selling stuff to came to him afterwards and said, hey, let's meet for breakfast. And he laid out, my dad thought it was just a classic business meeting, and it wasn't. It was basically a multi-level marketing scheme. Mm-hmm. And he laid out this amazing story of how, you know, it was guaranteed returns and all these things. And I'm sitting there as an 8 or 9 year old boy thinking, this is fantastic. This is awesome. And I watched my father go, yeah, thanks, but no. And I just was like, what are you doing? You're missing a great opportunity. Think of the toys that this could buy me. This is fantastic. And he told me someday you'll begin to see, you'll understand someday. And I do now. And if, you know, I want to go back really quick to Kurt Meyer, if that's all right.
Sure.
It's easy to say, and I said this in the story, it's easy to say the fool and their money is soon parted. But the idea here is that these schemes and the people who put them together are charismatic, great people who, at least to their victims, they seem that way, who make it make sense. And Kurt Meyer, who's the assistant U.S. attorney for the Western District of North Carolina, who's heard a lot of these stories, even he says that it's not so simple to be able to understand them.
But what you find when you interview the victims and when you get to know them is that what we do in this area is much like any other area in which we don't have a lot of information. I don't know about you, Tom, but when I go to the car mechanic, I find myself very vulnerable because I don't really know how my car works. And when they tell me there's something wrong with it, I feel like I have to listen to them. And what happens with these victims is they have a trusted friend, an advisor, someone with credentials, and who tells them with a lot of big words, usually, all the ways in which this makes sense. And when you hear it out of their mouths, it makes sense to you. I mean, I've literally been sitting in conference rooms with victims before, and when they are done talking, describing what was told to them, it sounds good to me, and I've been doing this for a long time.
And when you hear him talk, the attorney who prosecutes these cases, Robert, it sounds familiar because when you hear the pitch, you do fall for it. I've been to some multi-level marketing meetings, and the part of the charm, part of the way it works, I think, is the fact that you hear people who are in fact successful at this or want to be successful at this, telling people over and over and over and over how successful they are and how you can be too. And I would think that the pitch for a Ponzi scheme is not all that different.
Yeah. The thing is, they're successful at what? And here's the most pernicious part of the message delivered. They are arguing to you, persuading you, that success is based upon enrolling new investors into the scheme that you are investing in. They are portraying that as a sustainable, valid method of earning income.
Mm-hmm.
That's the trickery there.
I want to come back and talk more about that and see how that compares, to Jordan Maglich, with what happens when you're listening to a Ponzi pitch. We have to take a break. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and historic Brattonsville Christmas Candlelight Tours, Christmas in Colonial and Antebellum Carolina backcountry costume performances and family-friendly activities tomorrow and the 13th from 3 to 9 p.m. chmuseums.org. And Bricks Wood-Fired Pizza, serving gourmet brick oven pizzas, salads, and pastas, along with vegan and gluten-free options. Gift cards available at all 6 Charlotte area locations or online at BrixPizza.com. Well, Monday morning on this program at 9 o'clock, Ree Drummond will be with us. She's the Pioneer Woman Cooks of the Pioneer Woman Cookbook. She started life in L.A. or Chicago or someplace out there eating sushi, and then she's completely changed her life and has taken on a complete new career. And she's very famous. A great conversation. It's an encore presentation, and that's Monday morning because Monday night at 7, we are recording a conversation at Theater Charlotte to which you are invited. WFAE.org has all the details.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup. Protests erupt after a second grand jury declines to indict a police officer. 17 states sue President Obama over his immigration plan. And the Supreme Court hears a landmark pregnancy discrimination case.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about Ponzi schemes, of which there are many in operation even as we speak in North Carolina. We're going to talk about a little bit later on about why that is, because evidently we're in the top 20 in the nation in terms of these Ponzi schemes. Joining us to talk about all this is Jordan Maglich. He's an attorney with Wyand Guerra King in Tampa. He's also in the securities law and business litigation end of things, and he runs a blog called Ponzi Tracker. It's an internet blog. Tom Bullock is a reporter for WFAE News, and Robert Fitzpatrick is president of Pyramid Scheme Alert and the co-author of False Profits. We were talking about how even for attorneys who prosecute this, when they hear the pitches of some of these things, it sounds really good, and you start to buy into it. How much of this is simply the magic of the story itself and hearing it over and over and over, or do the perpetrators of Ponzi schemes have some special quality that the rest of us don't have? Jordan?
Yeah, I think it's a combination of both, Mike, and you know, I think Tom and Robert touched on it earlier. You know, you not only have these people running these schemes who are, you know, typically charismatic, they're either average education or above average education. They've got what people call the gift of gab. They've got this pitch down. They are often hold themselves as experts in the subject, and it's an area that other people won't know about. I think when you combine that with, you know, I think people have an innate, you know, want to trust people. And you, when you combine that with, you know, you certainly don't think that someone pitching you is trying to steal your money. So when you know, you combine those two things, it certainly makes a very devastating combination.
We call these things Ponzi schemes because of Charles Ponzi, who was arrested in 1920. What exactly did he do, Tom? because there were schemes like Ponzi's scheme,
sure,
prior to Charles Ponzi.
Yeah, you can go right back to Peter to pay Paul. I mean, these kinds of concepts have been around for a long time.
So how did he have the distinct honor of having his name attached to these schemes?
It's a really good question, and I dug a lot into the life of this man, and he's fascinating. I think it's because he was a pop icon in 1920. I mean, you know, Charles Ponzi was born in Italy. He was just outside of Parma. He came over to the United States about 1903, and he was an Italian immigrant at a time when Boston, where he landed, was full of Italian immigrants. And he worked his way up and down the East Coast doing odd jobs, but he's very clever. He was always trying to come up with a way to make money. He told the New York Times in an article when he was still being lauded as a financial genius that he came over with $2.51 in his pocket, and he had million-dollar dreams. And he also told the same story that he, ironically here, was victim of fraud on the boat ride over. He was on the USS Vancouver, and apparently there was a card shark, and he lost most of his money playing poker. But he gets here, and he does these odd jobs, and the core of the Ponzi scheme, believe it or not, it's all about stamps, these really arcane old things called – it was basically a way to get a stamp to send a letter back overseas. They were these coupons that you would you can enclose in a letter, and basically it was saying, hey, I want to hear back from you, so I'm going to pay for your postage. And these coupons had a set rate that was set in the very early 1900s, or I guess, you know, around 1900. I think it was 1908, if I remember right. And then World War I happened, and economies across Europe were devastated. So the value of the exchange for these coupons, which was basically one for one, if you bought one in Spain, which, you know, their economy was destroyed, and you sent it to the United States, you could exchange it for a U.S. stamp. So you could, you know, pay pennies on the dollar, in essence, for these coupons. So Ponzi got this, actually, came up with this idea after another failed business venture, and he suddenly said, you know, this could work. If I can get them sent over from, you know, countries like Italy and France and Spain, whose economies were tanked, and thinking about the foreign exchange and, you know, the value of the dollar, which was rising after World War I, I should be able to make huge profits off of this.
Did he set out to cheat people? Did he think it would work legitimately, or did he think to himself, I can make this work because even though the numbers don't work, I can rob Peter to pay Paul and keep the thing going. As long as it's going, it's okay.
It's a good question. And I don't think anybody really truly knows, because like a lot of Ponzi schemes, it's plausible. I mean, if you actually just looked at the economics of what he was doing, it's plausible.
Is that what makes these things difficult to uncover and to prosecute, Jordan Magledge?
Yeah. I mean, when you know, like Tom was saying, this sounded like a great idea, you know, the ability to arbitrage, essentially. And the numbers were the numbers. You know, the person pitching this to you has obviously done their research. You, as the person getting pitched the investment, has certainly not done as much research as they have. So it certainly sounds plausible. And, you know, I certainly wouldn't disagree with the statement that not all Ponzi schemes start out as intending to defraud people.
But,
you know,
but Ponzi people actually never traded those coupons. Mm-hmm. He just said he did.
Ah.
So it was seemingly plausible, but Clarence Barron of Barron's.
Okay.
Was the person who actually debunked it by saying the totality of the coupon market, put all those coupons together that exist in the world, weren't even near what Ponzi was claiming he was earning. It couldn't be done. In other words, there was not enough of such coupons. He never traded them anyway.
Not unlike the PTL scandal, where Jim Baker was accused of inviting people to come to his hotel when there weren't enough rooms to serve them.
Correct,
I guess. Go ahead, Jordan.
Well, you know, I've seen evidence that, you know, in the very beginning of this scheme, when he was just pitching it to family and friends, you know, he gave money to his relatives over in Italy and had them send it back to him. So, you know, there initially was the genesis, arguably, that, you know, he thought he could make this work. But, from what I've read, once he realized the economics of it and that there was a lot of red tape involved, he certainly did realize that couldn't work. And, you know, the Barron's article that Robert was alluding to, you know, I think there was something like 30, 40, or 50,000 coupons in circulation. And Mr. Barron calculated that Ponzi would have needed millions and millions of these coupons to make the numbers work.
So he defrauded people out of $7 million in 1920. What does that mean in 2014 money?
You know, I don't know the specific answer to that, but I can tell you this to put it in perspective. It's estimated he was taking in about $250,000 a day. And I know that works out to about $2.3 million a day in today's terms. So if you use that math, it's probably about $225 million.
Wow. Charles Ponzi scheme, the Bernie Madoff scheme, both relied on robbing Peter to pay Paul. There wasn't enough money in the bank to pay everybody back, but if only one or two people wanted things back, it was okay, and he could always show these fake returns on the balance sheets that he was sending out every month. Is that what all pyramid schemes essentially do, Jordan?
Well, I certainly can't speak specifically to pyramid schemes, but, you know...
Well, I mean, Ponzi schemes, excuse me.
Yeah, sure. I mean, it's a simple equation. A Ponzi scheme will continue as long as the fund inflows do not eclipse the fund outflows, because when that happens, you have a negative balance, and eventually you're going to run out of money. Fair and simple. That's why in the wake of the economic collapse, when you had all these people lining up asking for their money back, you had no one willing to invest their funds, these things collapsed.
That's the common factor, Mike, structurally, but the narrative is different in each one. In the case of the Ponzi scheme, of course, there's deception. As we said, Ponzi was telling people he was generating this money from trading stamps, but he wasn't. He was just transferring money from later investors to earlier ones. Same with the pyramid scheme. But Ponzi never claimed that transferring money from later investors to earlier ones was a legitimate way to generate money. He never argued that. He claimed he had another way to generate money. The pyramid scheme, more commonly, actually attempts to defend the process of constant enrollment of new investors to pay earlier ones as a legitimate form of business. Hmm. So today's pyramid scheme is not concealed, it's disguised. Whereas the Ponzi scheme always has to be concealed.
Well, there are those who don't like Social Security very much who have pointed to Social Security and called it a Ponzi scheme. Is it?
No.
Because it relies on younger people to be paying off a lot of older people for a long amount of time.
But it's transparent and it can be calibrated. That is, the amount of money coming in can be increased. The amount of money paid out can be decreased. And it's transparent. So those are two elements that a pyramid scheme, a Ponzi scheme, can't do.
And let's all not forget, too, that the person who is running Social Security has the ability to print money.
Yeah.
So if you're actually able to produce what you're promising to pay, you're always going to be able to, whether the value changes is one argument, but you it's definitely not a classic pyramid scheme.
Jordan, your PonziTracker.com blog lists the top Ponzi schemes in America. At the top of that list, of course, is the Bernie Madoff investment security scandal that resulted in a $1 billion in losses. But at number six on the list is something I did not know about. It's called the Zeke Rewards Scheme. It was based here. How did that scheme work?
Well, it was based in a couple ways. You've probably seen the television advertisements for, you know, online auctions. You could win a MacBook and pay $1.50. It was very similar to that, where, you know, Zeke offered participants varying ways to make pretty significant returns. It had what was called a retail profit pool, where you could buy some of these points, take a couple actions like putting up ads for the day or run an automated computer program, and get basically a 1.5% daily return, approximately. It also had a recruiting aspect, where it rewarded participants for the amount of people they were able to recruit to the scheme. So, and this thing took off, and it took off very quickly. At its peak, it had taken in hundreds of millions of dollars, and the Securities and Exchange Commission stepped in August of 2012, alleged that it was a Ponzi and a pyramid scheme, alleged that, you know, it had accumulated about $3 billion of these so-called profit points, and if all these investors elected to take all their winnings in cash daily, the scheme would run out of money within a week.
Yeah, the SEC called this a massive Ponzi scheme, and Frank Burks, who ran it, or at least was accused of running it, entered into a consent judgment, neither admitting nor denying the allegation, and agreed to pay $4 million in civil penalties. However, a court-appointed receiver believes there may have been as many as 2 million victims and losses as high as $600 million. So why was he allowed? Because I believe two other defendants pled guilty. Why was he allowed to get off,
well,
essentially?
He was actually indicted about a month ago.
Okay.
It certainly was not expected, but I think prosecutors were building a case, and they certainly had plenty of time under the applicable statute of limitations.
Okay.
But he was accused of multiple fraud counts. He has pled not guilty. And I believe there should be a trial in the upcoming months in early 2015.
And you say that the Zeke reward scheme could be the largest of its kind in terms of victims.
I think I'm pretty confident in saying that I think it is, certainly based on my research. I think the court-appointed receiver estimated that there's hundreds of thousands of victims. I think ultimately at least over 1 million invested in the scheme. Certainly, you know, a person who lost money but made it back more than they invested, you know, may not be considered a victim, so to speak, at least in the receiver's discretion. But you had hundreds of thousands of people who lost and did not recoup any of their investment.
You say that Zeke was unique because it was conducted over the Internet. I would think that the Internet would be fertile ground for things like this.
It is. And unfortunately, you know, Zeke has kind of marked a springboard for these kind of schemes, because you have such a large following in Zeke. That you had other schemes popping up, you know, nearly overnight, trying to take these investors and convince them to invest in similar schemes. Hmm. The Internet has significantly expanded, you know, it's been a significant boon for many industries. It has also significantly expanded the reach of many industries, unfortunately, including those that aren't legal. You had people posting on Facebook, on Twitter, all other social media, promising these crazy returns, and you had the ability, for the first time ever, to reach people you had absolutely no affiliation with, but just had mutual acquaintances.
And you have said that North Carolina is in the top 20% of states in terms of Ponzi schemes. I suppose this scheme could have been located anywhere. But in fact, you talked, Tom, to the attorney for the Western District of North Carolina, Kurt Myers, about this and the number of cases that he deals with all the time.
Yeah. In fact, that's how I came across the story in the first place. It just seemed like a steady flow of press releases from the U.S. Attorney's Office here in Charlotte that kept saying, Ponzi scheme, Ponzi scheme, Ponzi scheme. Or if you look at it, you know, it had some kind of a reference to pyramid scheme or whatever it may be. And there's a very specific reason for it. Zeke is an interesting example in the fact that it was based here. They actually operated in the jurisdiction of North Carolina. But there were cases that I noticed from all over that really could have been prosecuted all over. And so I asked Kurt Myers, first of all, since I, you know, prove my theory. Am I right? Are there a whole lot of these cases going on? And this is what he had to say.
I would say that we're in the half dozen to 10 for the past year or so.
Is that a lot?
It is a lot. It's not as much as you might think, though. We have noticed, particularly in the last 4 or 5 years, an incredible number of these cases. I think there's really two reasons for that. One is the bad economy. When the financial collapse happened in 2008, it really affected these kinds of schemes in two ways. One is it made victims more vulnerable. When your traditional retirement savings appears to you to be in jeopardy, you are much more susceptible to a con artist coming to you and telling you about a better investment that's going to save your retirement egg. And second is ongoing schemes can be uncovered because of a bad economy. When the economy is good, people don't ask for their money back. But when it's bad, they start asking for money. And when enough people ask for money back, eventually the con artist doesn't have any more money to give.
And you know, what he went on to say to me, Mike, is there are 10 white-collar attorneys in that office, and Kurt Myers is in charge of them. And he said at least half, so at least five, have a good part. Either they're solely prosecuting these kinds of cases, what he called it's their diet, or they're doing in part some of these cases. And it's given them the expertise that you just don't find in a lot of other places. So North Carolina is becoming one of the places you go to try these cases because they've got the experience.
So we have that going on. You have your organization, Robert, is based here about pyramid schemes. Is there something about North Carolina? Is there something about Charlotte and its can-do attitude, its business-like atmosphere where we want to make money and we want to beat New York in the financial world, et cetera, that makes this a particularly good place to find both victims and people preying on those victims?
Well, I think there is. I'm a native of Charlotte, so I think I'm entitled to make a critique of our city. In this respect, I think Charlotte has identified itself as a commercial culture. That's our ethos. Making money is what the city's about. And so, like they said, why'd you rob the bank? Well, that's where the money is. Charlotte is a place where the money is. But it's a psychology here in which making money is considered the highest of endeavors. It establishes your worth as a human being. Rich people are celebrated here and almost revered. So in that kind of a psychology, that's the perfect environment for the pyramid scheme, which makes making money almost a holy enterprise, something sacred. And not making money is almost sinful.
So, that sounds a little bit like an extrapolation of America at large, and only have 30 seconds here, Jordan, but in cities where this seems to be a problem or where you've noticed this as a problem, is something like that going on in the psyche of the people?
Well, you know, I think it's a kind of a demographic. You know, you have Ponzi schemes that typically target elderly people, you know, not only because they have a large chunk of money in the form of retirement to invest, but because they may be more willing to trust those perpetrators.
We have to,
let
me step in because we have to take a break. I'll let you finish on the other side of it in just a couple of seconds. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Children's Theater Charlotte, celebrating the holidays with the musical production Scrooge. Evening and matinee performances now through the 22nd. Tickets available at ctcharlotte.org. And Mr. Rogers Windows, a local family business since 1986, offering renewal by Anderson replacement windows and entry door systems installed by trained craftsmen. Product details at mrrogerswindows.com. Protests erupt after a second grand jury declines to indict a police officer. 17 states sue the president over his immigration plan. And the Supreme Court hears a landmark pregnancy discrimination case. Those are the stories and more that will be covered coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on The Diane Rehm Show during the weekly news roundup. The International Hour follows at 11. And if you'd like to join our conversation, email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org or search for WFAE on Facebook or Twitter. We're coming right back.
Neighborhoods change. That's just a fact, right? Sometimes, though, there is real money in making that change happen.
Where most people would see some sort of urban blight or decay, I saw opportunity.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Investing in gentrification next time on Marketplace. It's from APS.
Marketplace this evening at 6:30 on 90.7 WFAE. Listener-funded public radio.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about Ponzi schemes and the proliferation of them, particularly in North Carolina, here this morning on Charlotte Talks. Robert Fitzpatrick is with us, president of Pyramid Scheme Alert and co-author of False Prophets. Joining us from Tampa, Jordan Maglich, attorney with Wyangara King and the operator of PonziTracker.com. That's an internet blog. Tom Bullock is also with us, reporter for WFAE News, that we've covered, who's been covering the Ponzi schemes in North Carolina. I had to interrupt you in the middle of a comment. Mr. Maglich, go ahead and finish up.
Sure. Well, you know, I just wanted to point out that a particular demographic that seems really targeted by these Ponzi scheme perpetrators is, you know, the elderly population. These are people that have a high percentage of their wealth, not only liquid, but in their retirement funds, that they're hoping will sustain them for the rest of their lives. And one of the reasons that North Carolina seems to be up at the top of this list is that North Carolina is ranked in the top 10 in the number of people over 65 years of age. Mm-hmm. So that I certainly don't have a scientific data to support that, but you know the correlation to me speaks a lot.
When Charles Ponzi was arrested in 1920 for his scheme, and it made all the papers literally, and that's all there was to make. there wasn't even any radio in 1920 to speak of, except for KDKA. Information did not get around, and people were probably not as well educated back then as they are today. Now, you said that there's been a proliferation of these things even after Bernie Madoff. And Bernie Madoff's scandal was incredible. We not only saw people who he bilked moaning and groaning about all the money that they lost, we saw his family destroyed by this. Why then do these things continue? Why do people still fall for these things?
Well, again, it's a lagging indicator. You know, especially in the wake of the collapse, you had, again, people lining up trying to withdraw their money, which they thought and they were told was safe. So a lot of these schemes that have been busted in the last several years, and specifically in the years following Mr. Madoff's arrest, were schemes that were the product of years prior to that of investment managers starting these schemes.
But are there new startups? Are there people not starting new Ponzi schemes even as we speak?
Oh, absolutely. There's been an abundance of people to fill their places, so to speak.
Mike, one of the things on the demographic, the Ponzi scheme implies you have some cash, you have savings, you have investments, you need a return. Mm-hmm. But the pyramid scheme goes after a much broader demographic, people who work. It is, they don't really have money. They need money.
Right.
So Zeke presented itself not really as an investment scheme. It presented itself as a work-at-home scheme. That's the far more common pattern. The other demographic that you see pyramid schemes going after now are immigrants and students. Mm-hmm. And so the student is the newest one because in the past, students really didn't need a lot of money and they weren't laden with debt and they weren't fearful of their livelihoods in the future. But today they are. So the pyramid scheme approaches the student or the immigrant and says, we have a work plan for you. This can be your future. So it's very different from just being tricked out of your money. It really wants to engage your whole life.
Yeah, you say that Ponzi schemes are reliant on concealment, while pyramid schemes are reliant on disguise. Explain that.
Yes. So obviously Ponzi was not trading the stamps, and nor was Madoff actually trading stocks. They had to conceal that totally. No one could know that they weren't doing that. And once it was revealed, it was all over. Mm-hmm. The pyramid scheme has to disguise its money transfer as a legitimate form of business. They do this by getting people to buy a product. The purchase of the product becomes the way of laundering the money. And so people are led to believe that they are engaging in buy-sell relationships, but actually the buy-sell relationship has no profit to it unless you engage and enroll more and more investors into the scheme. It has to be disguised as a real business.
The other thing you say about pyramid schemes is that they are reliant on confidence. You have to have confidence in the person presenting the opportunity to you. Jordan, these people who put together these Ponzi schemes, people like Bernie Madoff, who would have thought that Bernie Madoff, who had this big company in Manhattan in this office building with two or three floors, was committing fraud?
No one. And at the same time, a lot of people did. At that time, you didn't have the amount of scrutiny and the amount of awareness that you see today, where people are ready to ask questions and people aren't afraid or scared to pursue some of these suspicions. You had a well-known whistleblower now named Harry Markopoulos, who had written to various regulators multiple times saying that his mathematic background told him that Madoff's returns were not only impossible, but that he was likely running a Ponzi scheme.
Are these schemes fairly similar across the country? I mean, Tom Bullock has reported on foreign currencies, Mexican bonds.
Oh, they're called pink ladies. How nice is that? It's strange. It's I think the core, the structure, the basic premise is very similar. I mean, it all boils down to some trusted individual who tends to prey on friends, church members, family, people that he knows that he or she has a relationship with. And they all sell some special something, some kind of secret sauce that is proprietary, that no one else has figured out, that will make everybody a whole lot of money. And from there, you just insert whatever the proprietary secret sauce is. You can swap out just about anything. And, again, as to the plausibility of these cases, as a plausibility of these schemes, that doesn't sound all that different from high-tech computer trading right now, where, the closer you are to the internet hub near Wall Street means that you get a trade slightly, milliseconds faster than others. I mean, that's the thing. It's always just some proprietary thing that people say, oh, okay. And you'd be surprised what you can actually swap in there.
Hmm. Yeah. Mike, there's one other factor that this is the more controversial one. Why are these schemes not being overseen, regulated, prosecuted more aggressively? Zeke was not hidden. Zeke was all over the internet. It was all the rage on the internet, especially among younger people. And if you looked on the internet, you saw tremendous numbers of defenders, websites touting it and promoting it. This thing was not hidden away at all. Yet nothing happened
for a long time.
Is
that because, Jordan, it takes a long time to build a case?
Certainly that's part of it. But you had Zeke, which was, you could arguably say that Zeke was at the forefront of this new generation of schemes that, are using the internet to promote themselves. You could argue that regulators really hadn't dealt with this kind of fraud before. And I think if you look at the kind of cases that have been brought since Zeke, I think you see regulators really taking a more keen interest in how these things work and, more specifically, how a lot of them are fraudulent.
If these things are proliferating and if the internet is becoming a hotbed of activity for these things, is it like playing whack-a-mole?
In one word, yes. when you have, like Robert was saying, and I agree with him, especially with these, with the pyramid schemes or ones that have a hybrid but have a pyramid scheme aspect, you have hundreds of thousands, millions of people who have gotten recruited to be in people's what they call downlines, that these people can basically move from one venture to another when it gets shut down. So you bring with you tens of thousands of people, and you can basically keep these things proliferating when another one gets shut down.
Let me share some emails that have come in while we've been talking. Andrew says, does the deregulation of the banking system and the lack of oversight over banking contribute to any of these Ponzi schemes or pyramid schemes to run the other financial get-rich-quick schemes? Are they correlated? Does one depend on the other? Or have they, in specific instances, depended on the other?
I don't think there's like a legal financial connection. There's a psychological, there's an environmental connection. What Tom spoke about, how Ponzi argued that I'm going to deliver to the average guy what the big guys get, the kind of returns they get. They offer you 5%, but they get 50%. That's what I'm going to offer you. So when you see bank executives, CEOs, insiders making millions, hundreds of millions and you're at minimum wage, or you're getting a half of 1% on your little savings account, you start feeling cheated. And the profligacy of the payments to people at the top becomes this incentive for everyone else to think they could get in on this too.
And Mike, yes. You know, one thing too, I'm not sure you can point to a correlation, but you know, you certainly, if you look at a lot of these large Ponzi schemes, you know, they have a large financial institution involved one way or the other. So you have almost an implicit kind of stamp of approval from these financial institutions that they're handling this person's money or this institution's money. And you seem to think that, oh, if the bank doesn't have an issue with it, I shouldn't have an issue with
and
it.
And why doesn't the bank have an issue with it? Does the bank have no fiduciary responsibility to look into these things, or is it just simply a transaction that they're facilitating?
Well, I won't comment on that too much in depth because we are currently suing a bank alleging that they are involved in a large Ponzi scheme. But certainly you could argue that some banks either deliberately or just choose to ignore some of these circumstances with the goal of, you know, keeping this large client who they're going to make large fees and commissions off.
And I think fees are the key there. I mean, let's not forget that these people are trading, in essence, whether it's real or not is irrelevant. They still get paid per transaction. So I think it varies from institution to institution, but there is a financial incentive that's pretty obvious for organizations to be involved with something like Madoff.
Okay. And these things are gigantic cash machines, too, more so than a regular business would be. Zeek drew in $600 million in about a year and a half. And Fortune High Tech Marketing, which was the other one, which ran for 10 years, brought in over 300,000 people, became investors in this. And these things are generating. And so they begin to attract financial institutions, big name people, and so on, as we saw in Charlotte. The wife of the president, the CEO of Bank of America, became a promoter of it, a prominent people in media and sports. So if you have an ethos in which making money is celebrated and held as the highest achievement and ideal, then how you make the money becomes less and less significant.
Martha emails, as a financial advisor for 14 years working primarily in Mecklenburg and Union counties, I have had clients come to me about withdrawing money from an investment under my supervision to invest in something I considered highly questionable. Ponzi artists choose their victims well. Many, many times the con man is someone who recently joined the client's church and has a foolproof way of making money. The question I give the client to ask that tends to shut down these nefarious confidence man is, ask for a prospectus and bring it to me. My clients know what a prospectus is because they get bombarded with them. All legitimate securities must have a prospectus filed with the SEC. No prospectus is a big clue that this opportunity, in quotes, is one to avoid. Is there a profile for the kind of people that these people prey on?
In my case, for pyramid scheme, I think you would be better off to look for a profile of a person that turned it down. That would be the rarity. Otherwise, the universality of this thing is you know, it's too much to break out. I think all of us are, and the Ponzi scheme may be a bit different, but the pyramid scheme is a universal incentive.
Jordan.
And Mike, you certainly see a targeting of what's called affinity groups. They call it affinity fraud. Includes certain demographic groups, religious groups. And, you know, in the case of, you know, you see a lot of Ponzi schemes that, you know, you say that this person was a member of our church, he was well-respected, but I think her name was Martha. Mm-hmm. I think her advice is really good, because in a lot of these Ponzi scheme cases, you see, you know, the state Department of Securities or whoever it is, and, you know, the Federal Securities and Exchange Commission say they were selling unlicensed securities. They didn't. Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say that Tom Bullock mentioned doing due diligence a little while ago, and I'm wondering how you do that on things like this. If Bernie Madoff can get away with this for years and years and years to the degree that he did, what kind of due diligence could his high-profile, high-dollar clients have done that would have uncovered him sooner?
It's tough to answer that. I mean, you know, Madoff also hid behind the allure of authority. I mean, he was seen by Wall Street people as being a genius. He was on the NASDAQ board. You know, he had a company that was considered a market mover. It's tough to say. I think Martha's tip for your average investor is a brilliant one. But the fact of the matter is if you get the right person in the right place of authority with the right resume who decides to go wrong, it's tough.
Do most people who are involved in Ponzi schemes that eventually collapse get anything back on the dollar?
I think Jordan would probably be able to answer that one pretty well.
Yeah, there's no official figure. My understanding and what you know, I interpret from IRS guidelines is it's usually pennies on the dollar. The IRS allows you typically to claim a theft loss of about 95% of your investment. So that's what I usually tell people is the source of my information when I say it's pennies on the dollar, as well as what I see. I think the average recovery is definitely in the pennies. To date, in my experience in the last 5 or 10 years, there's been exactly two that have returned 100% victims. On my webpage, I have the top recoveries in Ponzi schemes. I think the fifth or sixth one is in the 40%, so you can see how quickly that percentage goes down.
What about the perpetrators who are caught and found to be guilty? How many of them serve time? What kind of time do they serve? Do they lose everything they own? Do they have to pay restitution? What's generally the punishment?
Short answer is yes to all those. They generally serve time. You see judges typically being pretty harsh. I've seen people liken white-collar crime to financial homicide. You're wrecking people's lives. I think judges take that into effect when they're handing down these sentences. They're typically sentenced to the higher range of the maximum sentence.
And completely different for pyramid schemes, okay, though, Mike. Those are never prosecuted.
Sure.
As criminal, they're always civil cases.
Okay. We have 15 seconds. If you think you're in the middle of a Ponzi scheme, who should you talk to, Jordan?
One, a lawyer. They may be able to help you with that. Two, law enforcement.
Okay.
Then there certainly is no reason to delay.
Jordan Maglich is an attorney with Wyangera King, dealing in securities law and business litigation, and the operator of PonziTracker.com. That's an internet blog. Robert Fitzpatrick is president of Pyramid Scheme Alert and the author of False Prophets. And Tom Bullock has been following this story here on WFAE. Thank you all for the hour.
Charlotte Talk.